The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If this is your first time listening, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique.
So, this time we spoke to John Englehart, author of Bloomland. We spoke remotely towards the end of October and we had a good chat about his writing process and his approach to editing and tackling subjects from location to education.
Yeah, I mean, he was also spoke a little bit about the experience of lockdown and I think a kind of fallow period that's come because of everything else that's going on in the world.
Yeah, I think that's something that's affected quite a lot of writers, me included. It is an unusual period.
It is indeed.
Hopefully any writers out there with writer's block will find some of the conversations we've had with authors over the last 2 years or so useful. And
I hope so. It's why we're designated key workers. So, well, here is John Englehart.
I'm teaching an academic writing class, but its focus is violence and justice in America. So we're reading a lot of the work that I used as research for Bloomland. It's me kind of returning to that and talking about it with students has been really interesting and to hear their perspectives on all that. But in terms of writing, I haven't done any writing since June. This is my return to higher education after being out of it for 6 years too. So I'm also learning how to teach online. So I've just been so busy with that I haven't done any writing. So in that way, it's kind of, I guess, not good. But
have you found that non-writing space? Are there sort of ideas fighting around, or are you just enjoying not having to untangle things in your mind?
Yeah, I was working on a new book before the pandemic hit, and was making some progress on that, but In the past months, the summer was cruel in a lot of ways, and I've just like put writing aside for the moment. And I think part of it is that the new piece I'm working on deals with kind of remote intimacy, and it is set in the future in kind of a somewhat hopeful, somewhat dystopian landscape. And so I think it's probably good for me to just take this moment off to kind of like see where history leads us, because I don't know really how the historical moment will impact the goals for that book. So yeah. I think kind of putting that aside and just kind of trying to get perspective on this moment is probably what I need to be doing anyways.
Mm-hmm. And is that a sort of novel length thing that you're working towards?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very in the early stages. I was working on just the first chapter and, you know, taking a long time with that, laying the sentences down like bricks. But
and do you find you tend to sort of work on a project in bursts, or would you sort of put that to one side for a year, or is it a matter of a few weeks? Or and when you do come back, do you tend to sort of work on a novel from beginning to end, or sort of work a few pieces here and then jump to another project?
Yeah, I think once I'm into a project, I think about it pretty single-mindedly, and I don't really leave it for very long, because when I come back, I think it takes me a while just to like get back up to speed. This has been my longest period of inactivity since I started writing, probably these last months. I usually fixate on something and I try not to leave it for too long. I think the way I know I'm in kind of like that writing sweet spot is if I'm thinking about my the subject matter, and it becomes this kind of like lens through which I'm seeing everything. Like with Bloomland, for example, I just started seeing some of the themes I was working with just in everything I looked at, and it became just kind of like, an overarching or I don't know, systemic kind of like issue in my life and everything I was seeing. So, yeah.
And is the sort of pause you've put on that project at the moment, is that purely down to the subject matter and something that you feel needs to sort of stew or gestate a little longer, or is it the sort of the current situation, the pandemic and so on, that has offset your normal rhythm and normal practice in terms of writing?
I think it's both. It's hard to know, kind of like chicken and egg situation, because I think I have been so busy reorienting myself with teaching again and with just kind of like trying to live right now and get through each day. So there's that. But I think me saying that I need to take a step back to kind of, you know, take stock of the historical moment is kind of probably me just looking at or trying to find some kind of silver lining in it and say, well, maybe this is, you know, maybe not writing as writing too, and maybe, you know, time will give me perspective. And I think that's maybe a little hopeful.
Yeah, I think I can totally be on board with that. I reckon a lot of people are probably feeling that as well, because, yeah, lots of people's life situations are changing around this. And it is a completely unprecedented situation that I don't think that anything good, particularly stuff focusing on the pandemic, I don't think the best things will be written right now about that anyway. So,
yeah.
Step back's a really good idea, I think.
Yeah,
I think, I mean, I like, in terms of my writing, I've found is stopped writing pretty much since this pandemic, and not particularly because of a lack of time per se. I have had time. It's just having that lens, or being able to look at things and sort of pull out the important points is so difficult when everything is in turmoil. Which I don't know. I mean, I think there is a some aspect of the current moment that maybe does make it hard to have that conciseness that you need to write well.
Yeah,
we're also sort of certainty poor as well, aren't we? Like nothing, there's no stability to anything anyway. So it's just, not that I think everyone's become completely nihilistic and fatalistic about it, but it's sort of, yeah, you're so surrounded by shifting sands that, yeah, I don't know. You just don't know what next month is going to be like.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's my sense is that to write, you need, I mean, you don't obviously have to be 100% certain, but like some elements of ambiguity or doubt are essential in writing as well, but there needs to be a sort of core of certainty of where you're writing from, and that sort of all pervading sense of uncertainty at the moment kind of dampens the ability to set words down on the page. It feels that way to me. But I don't know. In terms of a routine, and like thinking back, maybe before the pandemic, so when you were writing, did you have any sort of routine, like on a sort of daily basis, or in terms of what you did when you sat down to start writing in a day?
Yeah. So in the before times, before the pandemic hit, I was waiting tables at night, and so I'd wake up in the morning, either would write at home or go to a coffee shop, and I would read a few poems and write for about 3 hours. And, you know, I like writing in the morning because the issues of the day have not clouded my mind yet. And I would try to write almost every day, 3 hours in the morning, sometimes at night if I had time, but mostly I would be at the restaurant.
Would that be the same, the restaurant where you were working the previous evening, or would you go to a different place?
You mean the like a coffee shop to go work at?
Yeah. The coffee shop wasn't the same as the restaurant. I mean.
Oh no. I worked at a high capacity restaurant. It's very, very loud. Would not be conducive to lighting at that workplace. There's a nice quiet coffee shop down the street that I would go hole up at.
And you said you wrote a couple of poems beforehand. Is that not a couple? Like, I don't imagine that you sat down and I will read two poems and then start writing. But was that because prose would sort of distract you from what you were writing, or do you also write poetry?
I don't write poetry, but I it's what inspires me on the sentence level, and I think that when I sit down to write. I'm not kind of like a fast drafter. I write kind of sentence by sentence, and it's hard for me to proceed if a sentence doesn't kind of sing in some way, if it doesn't kind of cast two shadows. And so I like to return to poetry to kind of remind me of the power of language on the sentence level. And that usually kind of inspires me to put words on the page. I think when I'm thinking too macrocosmically about plot and character and about kind of like what will happen in what I'm writing, I think that I think I get less inspired by that or daunted by it. And so I think returning just to some interesting words and phrases is kind of a way for me to kind of like settle down and realize kind of what I'm looking for in the like actual, you know, when I'm staring at the blank page, you know, I need a sentence. So I look at poems, and then I also go to my notebook, which is filled with kind of like short images and phrases that I think have like interesting syntax and you know, specific images, kind of like unapologetic specificity that isn't really poetry but is probably poetic language. And so I use those two things as kind of ways into my writing.
And is that notebook related to kind of just observations as you go through life anyway, or is that very much while you're in the creative space of whatever project you're working on?
It's a little sort
of directly related, you know?
It's a little bit of both. I think, you know, like I was saying earlier, I think, you know, when I'm far into a project and it's going well, I start to see my characters or my subject matter and everything. Inevitably a lot of the like poetic language I come up with feels, you know, germane to the story I'm working on. But, there's also a bunch of random stuff in there, but I use all of it as a kind of like a patchwork. Like I use it and I kind of collage sentences together, and I spend a lot of time, you know, I don't know why I don't date my notebook. I don't have sections. It's just a stream of language. And so I spend a lot of time flipping through it when I get stuck on a sentence, looking for something, interesting and germane to inject into it. So I feel like there's at least something interesting going on.
Mm-hmm. And are you a long-term notebook user, collector of notes?
Yeah. I have a stack of them.
I feel that sort of people of writers particularly seem to divide into either the people who do it quite compulsively or people who've never really got into the sort of carrying a notebook around thing. I find it interesting.
Are there certain sort of places or times of the day where you find you take more notes more, like when you're on public transport or in certain places or locales around the city, or is it just a random when inspiration strikes?
Yeah, it's definitely usually when I'm not at home. Anytime I'm traveling or listening to music, it's funny. A lot of the times when I would, you know, leave the house and kind of wish I was writing, that's when I feel like most inspired and feel like I wish I was at home writing.
it's strange how that happens, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. and that kind of like fear of missing out feeling, but I think that's what makes me kind of turn to my notebook, and you know, that like movement of the world inspires me more. So I write most of my notes kind of out and about for sure.
Mm-hmm. And do those notes ever sort of take the form of a finished section? Like, would you sort of sit down and write like a few paragraphs that you can then just place more or less unedited and into the piece you're working on, or is it more sort of prosaic and
every once in a while a paragraph will come to me, but yeah, for the most part they're fragmented sentences. Yeah.
And the poems that you sort of start the day with, how do you go about sort of finding them or choosing which to read at the start of the day? Is that something you have like the night before you sort of, no, tomorrow morning I'm going to read those? Or
yeah, I think more recently I've been you're really attracted to reading the collected poems of certain authors. So while I was writing Bloomland, I read the collected poems of Frank Stanford, the Arkansas poet. And that was really helpful to me because he is kind of like very imagistic and landscape driven. He's a Arkansas poet. So there's just a lot of like plant names, a lot of kind of like Arkansas vernacular in there. And I think that would help me. And that felt inspiring to me. And then right more recently, I've been reading the collected poems of Adrienne Rich. Really attracted to her writing on the sentence level. She just has so many amazing, kind of compound words, that she kind of strings together, Leaf Mold Paradise, you know, just like, I think just even just words and phrases like that kind of like ring in my ears. And that kind of like reminds me of the power of language and makes me feel comfortable kind of moving on my own writing.
Yeah. And do you working towards a project, in the sort of more long-term when you're planning, do you, for say Bloomland, for example, did you have to do a lot of research before that? Or was that more driven by the sort of characters that deliver the narrative stuff? Because there's three distinct characters. So I guess I'm interested in both the research and how you planned that and decided that sort of distribution.
Yeah. So Bloomland was a really research driven novel for me. So when I started, I wasn't necessarily thinking about writing about a mass shooting. That came a little bit later. But I was thinking about, issues of male aggression, issues of higher education and the promise of a higher education. Once I got a little bit more into my subject matter, I definitely, would go through periods of more research heavy, writing and compiling. And so I tried to read across disciplines at the beginning. I was reading kind of like sociological studies of, mass shooting. But then again, I would go outward. I read, The Will to Change by Bell Hooks, which is about kind of like male socialization and patriarchy, male rage. I read, Your Magical Thinking by Joan Didion, which is on, kind of like grief and losing a partner, which one of the characters, Eddie, you know, loses his wife in the shooting. And so, you know, that book was really instructive to me. There's a character who gets into birth education, Rose, right? And so I read The Birth Partner and other books about, you know, the birthing community and pregnancy. And so, yeah, each character, I was taking kind of like the raw material from my life and my own experiences, but I was trying to refract that off a lot of research in the book. So if a character was had a certain job or a certain past, I would go seek out either a sociological study or a work of fiction or even poetry. There's a book by C.D. Wright about, it's called One Big Self, and it's got kind of investigation into the lives of prisoners. And so that book of poetry was really inspiring and helpful to me. So I just kind of like search in a kind of like interdisciplinary fashion around all of my subjects as I'm writing about them. And that's really helpful to me.
Mm. And does that process start before you sort of realize that that this will be a project? I mean, do you have a clear sense of when our project begins? That you know, okay, now I today I have a vision of what this novel is going to be, and you start researching from there? Or is it a case that you're already in the midst of researching a topic just for general interest, and slowly the idea of writing a novel about it emerges?
Yeah, I think it's usually related to the project I've already decided to write. I, for whatever reason, you know, fixate on a character, a subject matter, and then I kind of feel like I'm exposing my own ignorance to myself writing about it, and so I stop, and then I go read something, and I try to take in a lot more than I put out. So it's definitely like it's the writing starts, and then almost immediately I start trying to find books about that subject matter. Round out my own limitations.
And what then is the trigger to start the writing? What sort of changes from one day to the next to make you sort of pick up the pen and go, okay, I'm going to start writing Bloomland. So.
Well, initially, for Bloomland as an example, I was initially inspired by setting. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest and moved to Arkansas in 2010, and moving from a liberal coastal city like Seattle to the south was a huge change for me. I'd never been to that region, and Arkansas ended up being kind of one of those places that was like the most beautiful, most unsettling, most misunderstood places I'd ever been. I was living in a kind of a small kind of quintessential southern college town called Fayetteville. And after living there for 4 years, I left back to Seattle, and I decided I want to write about that region because it was really inspiring to me. So that's where Bloomland kind of started. And then I went from that to thinking about, I was teaching for 4 years while I was there. And that was a really kind of like powerful experience for me. So I was thinking about higher education, promise of higher education, and young people kind of growing or trying to grow into their, selfhood and to adulthood, and kind of the how the promise of higher education kind of delivers or doesn't deliver on that fashion. I was thinking a lot about, the Greek system and the large amount of social control given to young men. So that kind of started to fold in.
But that was a sort of later, the initial sort of impetus was more the experience of the place of Arkansas and the strangeness compared with what you were used to. And I mean, if you'd spent those years working in higher education in Seattle or in where you grew up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the aspects around education and so on would have, you could have had the same sort of academic thoughts on that, but the sense of strangeness and the experience of that place. It sounds like that was the initial impetus for writing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it definitely started just in Arkansas, and me wanting to kind of write about that setting initially. The notes I had, while I was in Arkansas, I was writing a short story collection set in Seattle. I guess it goes back to the whole, like, you can't write about a place until you leave it kind of idea, which I think kind of is true both in terms of location, but also in terms of kind of like an emotional state, having to leave it. Once I had left Arkansas, I was kind of like really wanting to write about, but while I was there, I was writing a lot of notes about it and kind of compiling, knowing that I was probably going to write about it eventually. I was just kind of like, thinking about the setting and just thinking, really hard about my surroundings and what was different and inspiring.
Hmm. Do you think that's something like with future projects, is the place something that is a sort of important starting point, or it just so happened in that case it was?
I think it just so happened that way. I think with the next project that I'm working on, it didn't start that way. Yeah.
Hey, what you reading for?
This is where the benefit of reading comes into play.
Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
So you said, I just want to take you back to something you're talking about at Bloomland that has stuck with me a little bit, about the Greek system. So that is fraternities and sororities and things like that, yeah? So this is very alien to us. It's not something that we have in Britain. Mm. And I often think, thank fuck for that. Because it seems like it's, I don't know, that it seems like an almost inherently damaging thing to make people turn up to university and then kind of audition to be socially accepted in a way that I think probably happens informally anyway, just because young people are young people. But just think about it, it's just so often wrapped up in the culture that we receive over here about universities that it's kind of unquestioning. It's just like, oh yeah, that's just part of American college life. But thinking back to reading Bloomland, yeah, you can. It just seems like a way of churning out some messed up people.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting. The college I went to in Seattle didn't have a Greek system, so there weren't.
Oh, so it's not across the board.
Yeah, and even in, I think in other colleges, they're just varying levels of degrees of the kind of like social hierarchies that the Greek system enforces. So, and then it varies within the Greek system at universities. Some of them are a lot more, I think, cutthroat and classist and exclusionary. And some of them aren't. So I think the problem is just they're kind of like these institutions, set apart from the university that aren't really beholden to a lot of the university's, standards and, expectations and safety measures. And so they're kind of like set apart. And then you have, a lot of these, students is, you know, adults, especially in looking at, the young men and the fraternities, I think, like I was saying, are given kind of a lot of control over that domain. And in this kind of like, I don't know, more kind of like, I don't know, lawless kind of sphere, I guess you could say. And I think the way that it really reproduces, I think, racism and classism, I think was kind of stark to me. I was surprised when I came to the university, you know, how divided the students seemed to be among lines of race and class. And I think that you know, would have probably been the case without the Greek system or not. And so I don't want to kind of like hold that up as using that as the problem itself. I think there's a more underlying problem, but I think it lays it a little bit more bare, and it makes it a little bit more obvious, the people that are included or excluded from that system.
One question, and when a university does have a Greek system, does that mean everybody within all the students have to be within a fraternity or a sorority, or do they generally? There'll be some that are in, and then some students that choose not to.
Yeah, I wish I had some like hard numbers on this, but my impression is that it's not the majority of students at public colleges, like the one I was at. Are in the Greek system. I think that there's probably like a quarter or less of the students are actually in the Greek system. And so I think that, you know, a lot of students like apply or try to get in and don't. A lot of the students can't afford it, or a lot of the students don't want to be a part of it and opt out too. But it creates a really kind of like segregated community, because there's not a lot of cross mingling. And in fact, my experience and my observation, a lot of the, you know, fraternities and sororities really didn't intermingle with the students who weren't, a part of that culture. So, I think that's part of what I observed is kind of like a harrowing example of, like a social domination.
So in Bloomland, is it Rose, I want to say? There's a girl who comes from quite a working class background and arrives at university and needs to fit in. So she's one of the characters, the sort of three main characters. How did you decide on that sort of distribution? Or were they just characters that sort of just popped up in your mind and said that we're the ones to tell this story? These are the viewpoints to use. Mm-hmm.
I think earlier on, I did have some character sketches I knew I wanted to write from at least an adjunct's perspective or an instructor's perspective, and from a student's perspective like Rose. But I was, from the beginning, especially once I was writing about a mass shooting, I wanted to write from a certain circumlocution, certain kind of like writing a story from a kind of peeling back the onion kind of way, rather than a more, forward arc plot driven novel, because I wanted to kind of decentralize the shooting as the main event. I wanted to not sensationalize the shooting as kind of like a necessarily climactic or a large part of the novel. The shooting itself takes up maybe a page and a half in the book. And so I wanted the book to more focus on the kind of like social roots, kind of like the years leading up to, and what the characters go through, what their lives are like, 10 years before the shooting. And then I wanted to focus on the kind of like 10 years after. And so I wanted to kind of like, circle around the shooting without, touching it in a lot of ways. And so writing from the different characters in a kind of like alternating chapters was kind of my way of doing that.
Mm-hmm. And did you have that structure from the get-go? I mean, did you have, I can imagine there'd be different ways you could approach that sort of time span of, having one character, character telling the story 10 years before and then jump to the present day and then jump to a third character 10 years further on from the event. The way it works in Bloomland, it jumps in between the characters. Did you sort of have to play around with different ideas to find the way that worked, or did you kind of have that structure
it was a real mess at the beginning. the first chapter I wrote was actually a chapter where Eddie and Steven, the narrator, it was set, I think, 10 years or so after the shooting. And it was a chapter where they kind of like wander off into an ice storm and have an argument. And that chapter is now, I think, a sentence in the book. And the second chapter I wrote was Rose's chapter. And I think that chapter, kind of came out, as opposed to some of the other ones, came out kind of quickly. And I think that's when I kind of had found the voice of the novel. And that's that kind of like declared a second person voice that was really propulsive and, kind of like prone to kind of temporal distortions and talking about the future and the past. So once I had that, I had a little bit more idea of how I wanted the novel to work. And, I hadn't yet at that point decided that I was even going to write from Eli's perspective. I had a lot of reasons at the beginning to not write from his perspective. So I was thinking I wasn't going to, but, once I decided that was kind of important for me to do that, I kind of put together Rose, Eli, and Eddie somewhat early looking back and, wrote those initial chapters where, they're like 10 years before, or years before. And, that's kind of how it started.
And it was all from the sort of second person from quite early on then. That's interesting. I sort of assumed you would have made that decision after amassing quite a lot of material.
Yeah. So the first chapter I wrote was in first person, and then I wrote that Rose chapter in second person. But I thought surely I wasn't going to write the whole novel in second person, even after that Rose chapter and having the voice. And so there was a lot of resistance even internally for me writing in that voice. So I tried to write the next chapter in third person. And then in first person, and then it didn't work in the same way. And eventually, I started to kind of realize the strengths of second person for the subject matter, kind of moving the ego of the stories slightly off to the side, kind of implicating the reader. The novel, I ended up really wanting to be about kind of shared responsibility. So I think at a certain point, the second person started to justify itself, and it became a voice I couldn't get out of.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that could sort of start as an experiment, for want of a better word. But then when you see it's really holding water and doing the job it needs to,
yeah,
the right thing to go on.
Yeah, it's something it's quite unusual to read it, but then it quickly you kind of forget. I guess it's only sort of later on that you introduce the sort of narrator in a sense, and it seemed surprising in a way. I just kind of got used to second person as a stylistic means of telling story. I wasn't expecting somebody to sort of jump in and explain where their perspective was coming from.
Yeah, I think the fact that the second person turns out to be an actual person, that's right, isn't it? It's quite a while ago that I read it, but I feel like they are then directly addressed is very interesting to turn it around like that.
Yeah, I wanted there to be a central consciousness to the book. I felt like it was necessary. So at the beginning, when I injected the I into the second person, I hadn't yet decided that what specific character that was. That I at the beginning was just kind of me. And I don't know what this says about artifice, but I felt like at the end of the day, I'm always the one speaking, no matter how much I have behind my characters. And so kind of like, it felt like a way to be honest about who's telling the story in a strange way. And I feel like I didn't want to, kind of like just like trade off perspectives in the book. I wanted there to be kind of like a central consciousness or emotional core kind of threading through it. And eventually when I decided to make that into Steven's character, the reason for that, right, was because he conferences with the shooter days before the event, and he feels kind of responsible for the shooting in some way. And so that decision ended up being something that was helpful for me in terms of like injecting the story with, I don't know, more confusion, more hurt, more worry, than kind of like having a kind of like detached, authorial voice, or then having just like, well, here are three different perspectives, just kind of like, independent, instead of being merged in that way.
And when you got to, was there a sort of clear end point when you sort of finished writing the novel, so to speak, like where you got to the end of a draft and you were like, that's the ending, and you then went back to edit it? Or is your editing process more sort of as you go along?
Yeah, I wrote after I had those first three chapters set up, I wrote pretty much each next chapter just kind of in order as you see it in the book. There wasn't a ton of shifting around that happened after that. So I wrote pretty deliberately for a few years. And each chapter would take me about, 4 or 5 months. And I just kind of worked on them chronologically that way. But there was kind of like a fake ending to writing the book. And in July of 2017, I finished that last Rose chapter actually and ended the book there. It was a lot different than what it is now. But I ended the book with her, because I thought she was, and she is such an integral part of the story in terms of like the foil that she plays to Eli. And so I was trying to end the story with her to kind of give her the voice of the novel. Almost a year after that, after I had been submitting it to agents and to small presses, I got some new perspective on the book and felt that kind of the themes, I felt that I had been maybe a little too subtle with some of my themes. And so I felt like the novel needed to end with Stephen and Eddie in the way that it does, the years into the future. So I wrote that last chapter a year after I thought I'd finished the book.
And was that a result of feedback from other people or just something that hadn't you at the back of your mind, you hadn't realized, but it just didn't quite sit the way you wanted it to?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. It's one of those things where I think that chapter, I kind of felt intuitively that it wasn't quite right, but you have nothing more to say at that moment. So you send it off to people and you hope they'll, say the opposite and just say, oh no, that actually works perfect. And I think that, but that made me really on the lookout for any time someone would say the ending kind of needs some work or something. And so I, was sensitive to that because there was a voice in my head kind of doubting that that was the real ending of the novel. And I think I got enough people saying that it wasn't quite right. Or people just not, in terms of subtlety, their feedback, in hearing it, I would think, I'm not sure that the themes of the book really came full circle in the way that I wanted them to, based on what you're saying about how the book impacted you. So I felt like that was kind of a impetus for me to dive back in and write that last chapter.
I mean, that's an important thing though, isn't it, about knowing which advice to listen to and which, you can sort of tell if it sits right or not. Because I think in my complete naivety, when I finished the first full-length thing that I wrote and was sending out to publishers and agents, it will never see the light of day. It was nowhere near good enough. But I just thought, well, I know there's problems with this, but someone will see the writing and then an editor will help me fix all of these problems. Which I think was just a ludicrous thing, looking back over a decade and thinking, oh, yeah, deeply naive.
And I guess thinking about editing, when you finished that first draft, or like the initial version of the book in 2017, did you then sort of embark on an editing phase, or was it pretty much there by the time you'd got to the end of that draft?
It was, for the most part, with each new chapter that I wrote, I would send to some trusted readers that I had. And I was also a part of a fellowship from 2016 to 17 at a local writing nonprofit. And so I had five other writers who were reviewing kind of each chapter as I wrote it. So that was helpful. And I think that made it so that the novel and the chapters themselves were, edited already. So when I finished the novel, I sent the whole thing, back to some of those people and then, some new people and got some thoughts on that. So I edited that, so I was saying earlier, kind of like I write like laying down bricks. I write kind of like sentence by sentence, and my editing process, for better or worse, isn't really,
it's not something distinct that happens after you've written a draft. It's something that's kind of integral to the writing process itself.
And my writing process makes editing really hard too, because each sentence is kind of constructed to really not be edited because I'm just so focused on the images and the writing and the poetry or the sentences that if I have to go back and take something out, it's so wasteful. So it makes editing really hard and frustrating, I think, for that reason too.
Well, I was just going to ask if that means that you find yourself stuck in dead ends more than you might. I mean, dead ends sounds so derogatory, but you know what I mean? Like, because of the way it's pieced together and you can't quite make that next step, do you ever feel that you sort of boxed yourself in?
Yes. Yeah. One of the hardest things in writing Bloomland was starting a new chapter. Because I think getting, I don't know, especially towards the middle of the book, having constructed this tightly wound voice and this tightly wound structure of each chapter, having to do that again, recreating that each time, was really difficult and frustrating. And So I had a lot of constraints that confounded me for sure. Mm-hmm.
Did you find that it changed a lot when you were getting feedback at the end of each chapter? Were you then rewriting that chapter much, or was it mainly sort of people picking up typos or small changes, or did you ever sort of get to the end of a chapter, send it out, and then get feedback, and that made you start thinking about this major rewrite of that chapter?
Yeah, I would. I think mostly in those, I was really worried about kind of the global issues of character, and I was really concerned about reproducing harmful stereotypes. I was really concerned about not injecting enough empathy or understanding towards my characters, and so those are things I was very concerned about in the early drafts. And when I would get notes on that, I would go back and try to reconsider, a character's actions or kind of there's a lot of interiority in the book, a lot of characters kind of like thinking through their own, kind of decisions and justifying them to themselves. And, I think early on, for example, a lot of Eli's, justifications and internal thought processes were, more abstract. And I think that's one thing that, my editors really focused on, and kind of called me out for. Similarly, I think the way that, Arkansas was presented in those early chapters, my partner, grew up in the region. And so she essentially worked as my editor too throughout this whole process, which I'm really thankful for. And she was one of the people who was really, locked into the idea that, Arkansas shouldn't be presented as this, I shouldn't be writing about it as an outsider. And I shouldn't be writing about it, in this way of kind of like looking down on it. And so she kind of like, alerted to me those passages that seemed, a little bit like finger wagging or whatever. So that was really helpful. So those are some of the issues that I really struggled with early on.
That's like, is it called sensitivity editing when it's about sort of gender and race and things like that, but you just had local color sensitivity editing from your partner?
Yeah.
And there's probably a lot of books that might be really improved by that. I think you think about it, it's very easy to fall into that sort of outsider perspective about places. The finger wagging, as you say, I think that's easily walked into.
I guess especially it seems there's quite a rift in the States between different regions, like Arkansas and Seattle, for instance. They seem, not having been to either, they seem a million miles apart in a lot of dimensions.
Yeah, and in my experience, I think growing up in the Northwest and the kind of liberal coastal cities, after growing up there and then going to Arkansas and coming back, I kind of realized how, the South is kind of, unjustly maligned. And I think that the liberal coastal cities, I think, kind of have this puffed up notion of themselves as these more ethical places. When really I think the same kind of like, unjust systems are present in both regions. It's just that they're just given different names. And so I think, what I kind of ended up feeling, that's one of the reasons why I had one of the characters, I had Rose, move to Seattle, at some point in the book, because, I started to worry that I had presented Arkansas as this like, uniquely, gun crazy, or this uniquely racist, or this, uniquely kind of like, macho showmanship driven place. And so to have her move to Seattle and kind of find the same issues present here, was important to me, kind of to point my critical lens somewhere else and kind of to pop that notion that like, this is set in Arkansas because this is the only place that could happen. And instead kind of like turn that, you know, back on a place like Seattle was really important.
Well, thank you to John Engelhardt for joining us from the Pacific Northwest, and thank you to you for listening.
If you liked what you heard, do check out some of the other episodes that we've recorded. There's 34 other talks with authors about their process and technique. You can find us at all the usual podcast places, or we're at unsoundmethods.co.uk, or do send us a tweet on Twitter at unsoundmethods.
Yeah, and you can find out more about me and my writing at Jamie Batchen, spelt my own peculiar way, on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchen on Instagram, or my website is jamiebatchen.com.
You can find me and my writing at LachlanBloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at LachlanBloom. Thanks again for joining us, and see you next time.
Okay, take it easy.